This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear from the man who has his eye on becoming Bloomington's next city manager. Steve Rasmussen is the interim city manager dealing with a council and mayor not getting along.
I'd like to be an influence to help try and bring them together because councils always do have differences.
Rasmussen talks about council interaction, politics, and the projected $3 million budget deficit. Congressman Darren LaHood is optimistic the GOP tax plan will move to the president's desk. Charlie Schlenker caught up with LaHood at a McLean County Republican Party breakfast. And during an edition of GLT's Date Book, hear about some Christmas elves helping to make some families' holidays a little brighter. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's November 20th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Assistant City Manager Steve Rasmussen is now serving as interim city manager. The council picked Rasmussen, who started in late 2014, to take over as David Hales departed this month. Rasmussen has worked on the city's solid waste issues as a liaison between the city and downtown and gained a reputation as a bridge builder and someone who gets things done. He's now responsible for all city operations, including helping the council close a $3 million budget gap. Rasmussen says there's not much difference between assistant city manager and interim city manager because he's doing both jobs.
As the as a city manager, there's just a lot more issues. Now, I was involved in a lot of them, but I'm more critically involved in things like the council agenda, because before I would kind of take it as it came a little bit, but now I'm involved in making the decision on that. I'm also involved in more detailed work on the budget. I've got to tell now more department heads yes and no on certain things. Before I was responsible for five departments. Now I'm responsible for 12 of them, so I have to spend a lot more attention to some of those other departments. The police department and the fire department, I've managed police departments and fire departments before in three different cities, but we've got a great fire chief and a great police chief, and so I didn't have to spend a lot of time talking to them. Now I've got to get a little more involved in those aspects of the job.
Agenda and budget are a couple of things we'll talk about in a moment. There were a few meetings for aldermen to actually decide upon you as interim city manager. Was there a hang-up, and what was it? Was there some sort of hold-up?
Well, since that was those were done in closed sessions, I wasn't privy to those, and even if I was, I couldn't talk about them, so I don't know.
You worked under David Hales for 3 years. How do your management styles differ, do you think?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question. David and I are dramatically different personalities. That doesn't in any way mean that we're different in terms of our professional code of ethics and our dedication to the profession, but we are very different, and I like to think that then we complemented each other. He was very studious and very academic. He came from a finance background. I'm an engineer and came from a building background, so my building and his analysis kind of fit together. I kind of joked with him. I said, you know, your solution to a problem is to do a fiscal analysis. I was a paratrooper for 30 years, so my solution is to attack.
Get the job done.
So I would push him forward, and he would hold me back, and we kind of reached an accommodation there. So I told the staff here on the first day that we had our staff meeting, I said, so now David's not here to hold me back, so you're going to have to do that a little bit.
The GLT newsroom had heard stories about, and they weren't highly critical, but that David was maybe sometimes over-involved, maybe a little bit of a micromanager. I don't know if you saw that. And how do you approach sort of managing people, managing projects?
Well, I wouldn't comment on that on David, because he did a great job in a very tough situation, and so every person handles it differently. I've got to do a lot more delegating right now because I'm both the assistant and the manager, so I've got to delegate it out. But what happens to anybody in one of these jobs is there are certain things that either take your interest or that you have an expertise on, and so you tend to micromanage those things that you know best and delegate out those things that you're not so familiar with, and I think that happens to anybody.
It could take more than a few months to get the next city manager selected. You've stated you would be applying for the job. Why is it of interest to you?
Well, I think two things. Number one is that I think I can help the city out and do a good job. As long as you can contribute, you can continue to do that. And we've got a lot of projects that we've got on hold that I'd like to see move forward.
Well, give me a couple of four instances.
Oh, sure.
Projects that are on hold that you'd like to see move forward.
Okay. One of them is we're very crowded in City Hall, and yet we've got a lot of space in the government center. And one of the things that David Hales had given to me was to do the space needs study and see what we can do to move some stuff from City Hall to the government center and spread out City Hall. We've had a couple of studies on that. We've got that out for a while. I'd like to go ahead and move forward on that. We can get that done.
Another one?
Another one is we have a critical need to move the Public Works garage and facility. It is just it's a dreadful working conditions. It's inefficient. Do better work and move it out of what is really the City Hall campus.
That's interim Bloomington City Manager Steve Rasmussen. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Are the council and mayor more fractious now than at any time since you arrived in Bloomington?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I kind of see him as the same as it's always been. I'd like to be an influence to help try and bring them together because councils always do have differences, and so I'd like to do whatever I can to help facilitate that.
How do you pull them together to work more closely? Because if you compare Bloomington and Normal, which is just two, they seem to have different approaches, seem to get along differently. One seems sort of to pull together more often than the other.
Well, it's not my business to manage the council. My business is to manage the staff. But wherever I can, when I can work to offer suggestions or to negotiate things that might help them out, I would like to do that.
What do you think of the ward system? Just a general question about how communities are organized, and sometimes it's an at large position, sometimes it serves a specific part of the city.
Yeah, I've worked in cities that have done both. I was a city administrator in a city where everyone is elected at large, and I was in a city where they were all done by wards, and both of them can work if they work together, and I think that the community has voted, they've spoken on what they want, and I think our job is to make that work.
But you do see some room for improvement as it concerns council relations, how they get along with each other and how they get along with the mayor?
Well, I'd certainly like to help that. There's always room for improvement, for sure.
Alderman David Sage has proposed a structural change affecting how aldermen place things on the agenda. It would take 5 aldermen signatures, which is an increase from the 4 it currently takes, and it would bypass the mayor, as I understand it. Mayor Renner thinks this is harmful, and here's what he had to say to GLT News on Tuesday.
The particular agenda that they're setting, that Alderman Sage wants to bring forward, would absolutely strengthen the ward system of the 9 members of the city council. And that is, we currently have 9 members of the city council that have separate constituencies, and I'm the only one the mayor is the only one elected at large. And so none of us have the same group of people that we're accountable to. And I absolutely oppose any movement toward creating a ward-based Chicago-style politics, which is, I think this is, would move us in the direction of. This is something we will discuss at the next meeting.
That's Mayor Renner speaking with GLT News early last week. Is this structural change necessary?
I don't know whether it's necessary or not. We've got half of the council who may be supporting that because they put their names on the aldermanic request form to take that issue up for discussing. I can presume, I guess, maybe that the other half may not be for it. The mayor would like to see that as being an issue of strengthening or not strengthening the ward system, and I think that's up to the council to decide, and I at this time, the staff and I wouldn't take a position on that. That's for them to decide.
Are there any agenda items that are that currently get the four signatures to place something on the agenda by aldermen that don't make it onto the agenda?
I don't know of any at this time, but of course, I've only been doing this for a short period of time, and so far, I've only got one, and that's the one. And
But looking back, you're not aware of any?
No.
And what about items that have been placed on the agenda by aldermen or by the mayor that have actually failed? I guess what I'm getting at here is whether or not this is a solution in search of a problem.
There may be that. I know some of the aldermen feel very strongly about that, and certainly I'll do everything to help facilitate that discussion so that they can come to a good solution to it. I'm neither do I personally want to take a position, nor do I have an official position on that. That's a council issue. I will say one thing though, and that is that I believe that the agenda is the council's agenda. The council is able to move forward its priorities by the things that it puts on the agenda and handles. And so I would like the council to have a strong hand in developing that agenda and determining what it is they want to move forward.
That's a sort of a global agenda, not a every 2 week, not the specific agenda. You're talking about their agenda of things they actually want to accomplish for the city?
No, I'm talking about the every 2 week
thing.
Okay. You know, if they want to continue to put things on there that, for example, strengthen the downtown, well, one of their priorities is to develop the downtown. So I would think that there would be things that would appear on the every 2 week agenda that are downtown issues. And that's the way they move that priority forward.
If you had to rank the priority of this kind of measure being proposed by Alderman Sage in comparison with, say, dealing with the city's solid waste costs, how would you prioritize those two?
Well, they're two different things. The solid waste issue thing is a service level issue and a budget issue. The aldermanic request form is a policy issue and an internal operating measure.
Sure, but the council only has so much time to talk about things that are important, right? So, you know, if we're talking about dealing with bulky waste and solid waste, or whether or not, or making a structural change about how things get on the agenda, it seems to me that one of those is more important than the other. You're saying they're on separate lists?
They're two different things. You know, it's like if I ask you, do you walk to work or carry your lunch? Well, you know,
both.
Yeah,
maybe. I bike to work and carry my lunch.
Okay.
As assistant city manager, you work to trim costs, develop plans to cut solid and bulky waste costs. The council ultimately never really made a decision, and to my knowledge, a task force of three aldermen appointed by the mayor to examine this issue never reported back. This can of worms was seemingly closed when the council approved a sales tax increase that closed the last structural deficit 3 years ago. Are we back to where we started 3 years ago with having to look at solid and bulky waste costs?
Yes.
And what do you do? If the council was unable to make a decision 3 years ago, are you confident they'll be able to make a hard decision about actually trimming bulky waste or solid waste services to save money?
Okay. When I say yes, rather bluntly, I say that because at the council retreat that we had two Saturdays ago, we talked about priority-based budgeting, and we talked about the things that were high on the list that we wanted to make sure we continue gave adequate funding to. Okay, great. At the bottom of the list, those things that we didn't want to give funding to help balance the budget, we didn't get a lot of specifics, but we did get 13 areas that they wanted to look at. They said, let's look at these 13 areas for trimming the budget. So I have the staff working on that now, and I promised we'd get back to the council by the end of the month, by the end of November, with something on each of those 13 items. At the public meeting, and that wasn't a secret, but on that was solid waste again. And so we need to take a look at that because we have a high level of service, but we also subsidize that to a great deal. That is one area of the 13 that will be looked at as a possible way in which we can help balance our budget.
Can those 13 areas add up to $3 million to address the structural deficit?
Oh, easily. But the issue on those 13 items is that as we look through it, and I've asked the staff to give me kind of a one-page memo on each one of those, and the staff who is an expert in that particular area, to see if there's light at the end of that tunnel. It may be that some of those just don't work. You just can't get there in the next year, and they'll fall off. But I think there will be three or four or five of those that will be ripe for the council to make a decision on.
We talked about the budget and solid waste in March of 2016, Steve. I want to play my question and your answer, and then we'll talk afterwards. The Budget Task Force spent a chunk of last summer and fall working through revenue and cuts. Areas to examine were the city's three golf courses, the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, solid waste, trying to recover costs on needed police protection for downtown Bloomington. Where do all of those stand now that the budget is essentially balanced?
Well, all of those things are still being looked at. In fact, the golf is going to be looked at here again in this coming week and answering some questions about that as to whether it might be more beneficial to task out, contract out some of those services or not. So that is still up in the air, but it is being looked at.
That audio is from March of 2016. Are the high-cost programs I mentioned, in fact, not all of them are high-cost. The police buyback wasn't necessarily that much money. Are those programs and options the city council needs to address in order to close this looming $3 million deficit?
Well, two of them out there are still out there because two of those that we mentioned there 2 years ago are still two that that were listed on the list of the 13 things that the council talked about last Saturday.
Golf courses.
Golf and solid waste. So we're going to take a look at that. Two that you did mention there, I think, aren't probably going to be looked at now. The BCPA, we had the vote on that last council meeting. The council voted not to turn that over to Venue Works. And so I take that as an indication that we're going to kind of continue with the BCPA and the Creativity Center the way we are. I told Jay Tetzloff immediately after that meeting that we need to go out and hire a new performing arts manager, which has been on hold now since the unfortunate death of Tina Salamone. So we're out moving forward on that. But one thing we are going to try to do in that is we're going to try to make it less costly so that we continue to provide a cultural venue for the city, but we don't want to have as much of a deficit there. I said we don't want to have a target on our back for those things. So we're working on that. And the police buyback, we went through that, and we went through several options, didn't come up with anything on that, and so I think that one probably is not going to be taken up again.
But it was only, what, $160,000, something like that? It wasn't a lot of money,
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, it wasn't a lot of money.
I mean, you're looking at a $3 million deficit. I mean, every penny counts, right? But you have to look at the areas that are going to bring in the most
exactly.
money.
Exactly.
One of the other positions at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts that's vacant is a grant writer. And one of the public speakers at the last meeting made the point of saying these are the positions that would help us actually reduce the deficit. Is the grant writer, along with the executive director, also on the list of positions to rehire?
Yeah. Yes. And we call that a grant writer. I think what it is we're calling that a development director, which will be grants, fundraising, all of those things that will help reduce the deficit that the city has to pay for that.
Do you think you mentioned trying to make sure you were able to hold the line on costs as it concerns the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts? Do you think that the BCPA or the Coliseum won't ever be in the crosshairs? You know, of things to, you know, because they're generally thought of as controversial, right? It's a public subsidy.
Well, it may be that it's always in the crosshairs because there are people that will think that that culture may not be something that we ought to spend public dollars on, and there are some people that think we do. So it's always going to be an issue. But I think that if we reduce the subsidy that we pay for that down to much less than it is, it will become less and less of an issue. I give you the perfect example is the golf courses. We can make the golf courses so that they're break even. We get pretty close to that. And then at that stage, who would complain? People who don't like to play golf, well, don't play golf then. But we can make it so that we're not using taxpayer dollars to pay for that, and that helps eliminate it as a controversial issue.
So would that be a fee increase for people using the golf course?
I don't even think it's so much of a fee increase as much as it is to make sure that we use it to the full extent that we can, and to have, instead of putting money into capital expenses, there are a number of golf groups that would like to do fundraisers for the golf course, so you can do some of the improvements to the golf course without using taxpayer money. And if you do that, I think we can make that pretty well break even.
As it concerns taxpayer dollars, are there any revenue proposals hiding in the wings, or will the city balance the budget by cutting? They've already taken property tax off the table.
Yeah. Well, amongst the 13 things, there were a couple of things. One of them is cost recovery. We don't do an awfully good job about doing things like collecting parking ticket fees. There's a lot of water fees that are out there that haven't been completely collected. And if we're more rigorous about collecting the fees that are owed us, that's important. And that's not a raise of taxes to anybody. Another one is cost recovery for the things that we do. For example, we do a lot of apartment inspections for health and safety. The Community Development Department years ago recovered about 90% of its costs in terms of charging fees for that. Today, it only does about 40 or 50%. Why is that? Well, let's go back and take a look at that and see if we can't have some cost recovery. That isn't raising taxes, but it's recovering fees.
The things that the Budget Task Force looked at in 2015, was there any progress on any of those? What are some of the hard decisions the council did make over the past 3 years? Since they knew the structural deficit would return, what are some of the things that were done in order to save money?
The last thing that we had, one by one, those each closed off without having taken action on it. And the last thing that we had was the police buyback. And we had tried several different solutions to that. One was to increase fees to the bar owners downtown. Of course, they objected to that. There was increased fees to all the bar owners all around town. And we never found a solution there that would get acceptance. And so that one kind of fell off the table. But at the same time that we raised the sales tax, and so that, I think, eliminated the pressure to take any of those actions. But they'll come back again.
You seem to be in a difficult position. We talked a little bit about this before you walked in the door or as you sat down for this interview. You need to guide the council through effective policy decisions, especially as it concerns the budget. But the council seems mired in infighting among themselves. How do you do your job to get to that budget working with this council? Or do you see that as an issue?
I don't see that as an issue, and I have good relationship with all of the council members. I admire them all for the work they're doing. I appreciate the hard thing that they're struggling with, and I try to do the best I can to lead the staff to accomplish their goals and objectives. And I think the way we help solve some of those is, like with the budget, is to come out with practical solutions that everybody can buy into, as opposed to causing it to have winners and losers. We need to have everybody be a winner.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with former assistant and now interim city manager Steve Rasmussen. Is this a well-informed council? Are they familiar with key documents that are supposed to guide the city, like the Bring It On Bloomington Comprehensive Plan?
I think a lot better. They're a lot better informed than a lot of people would give them credit for. And the staff works all the time to continue to inform them about those kind of issues. And so I believe that the council is a lot better informed than people give them credit for. And I'm going to keep working to make that happen.
And what about staff? And I'm thinking of the sewer oversizing project at the Grove subdivision and the intersection expansion at Ireland Grove and Tawanda Barnes, both of which seem out of step with the comp plan that, put simply, says focus on the core of the city.
Well, let's talk about the first one. Would be the intersection of Tawanda Barnes and Ireland Grove. We worked with the county a lot on that here recently because of exactly the issue you're talking about. It's the county's number one project. It's their area of the highest number of crashes, and it's a terrible bottleneck in the beginning of the day. We have an intergovernmental agreement with them that said that we would split the cost of that 50-50. Now, it's become more than we probably thought we were going to pay. And so what we did was we brought that before the council, and the council, I think wisely, decided to table that, but send it back to our new transportation committee to work through. And you balance the need of, as you said, the core of the city versus the problem that we have with traffic and accidents in that part of the city. And that transportation committee meeting here in a couple of weeks is going to look at that, and we're going to get the county in there, and we'll analyze that. And I think we'll come up with something that will probably be a compromise that everybody can live with.
And what about the comprehensive plan, your view of the comprehensive plan? What do you think of it?
Well, one of the problems with the comprehensive plan is with all of them is we've got, I think, a 168-page document, and on one page, there's a paragraph that talks about how we should improve the wayfinding downtown. And so we took that one on, and the council put $250,000 into the initial year of that, and we've now had 48 meetings, and... And we're getting ready to take it back to the council again.
And you have two or three new wayfinding proposals now, right, for sign styles?
Yeah, we do. So what I say is, well, you know, you got that comprehensive plan, and you got to pick something out of it to do. And there's a lot of stuff in there to do.
Sure. I guess I'm asking how you view it as interim city manager, perhaps the city's next city manager, as an overarching document to help guide the city. Is it a reference guide? Is it a Bible for the city?
Well, I think there's two different things. I think it's a reference guide, probably not a Bible. And what happens is it's good because when we go back and take some project on, like why are we going to spend $250,000 to improve the wayfinding in the city? Well, we have a good reason for doing that is because the comprehensive plan said that's one of the things we should do. When we start looking at parking downtown, why are we looking at parking downtown? We did a big study. The comprehensive plan says that's one of the things we should look at. So we have good reasons for doing the things that we would do, and that is because it's put in the comprehensive plan. But we can't do it all, and so we have to choose wisely which of those things we can do. I don't know if you ever remember the movie City Slicker with Billy Crystal in it. Mm-hmm. And the old cowboy raises his finger, one thing, and Billy Crystal says, "What's that?" And he says, "Doesn't matter, just do one thing." That's the way I am.
Okay, Steve Rasmussen will have been on the job as interim city manager for 2 weeks tomorrow. Steve, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank you very much.
Rasmussen will likely serve until a more permanent city manager is hired. Alderman amended an ordinance restricting an interim serving only 4 months, expanding the term to 6 months. Rasmussen says he will be a candidate for the job. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Soderstrom Skin Institute. Founded in 1973, their team of board-certified dermatologists treat acne, psoriasis, eczema, skin cancer, and all diseases of the skin. Soderstrom Skin Institute has immediate openings for dermatology appointments at 2100 Jacobson Drive, Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, IPR's Politics Roundtable talks about the Rauner campaign and the opponent on which Rauner has set his sights. And during an edition of Datebook, you'll hear about an annual effort to help families during the holiday season. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on GLT. Congressman Darren LaHood says he's stopped predicting what will happen in the Senate, but he's still optimistic a tax bill will pass this year. That's in spite of the fact a comprehensive bill hasn't made it through Congress in 31 years. At a GOP breakfast in Bloomington this morning, the Peoria area Republican says he thinks there's a better chance for passage on the tax bill than there has been on health care because more Republicans share the same ideas on taxes than on health care. Past tax reform packages have generally expanded the deficit, but after the speech, LaHood told GLT's Charlie Schlenker, this time will be different.
Well, I think it's a combination of things. If you have a growth rate at 3 or 4%, which tax reform will do that for us, that means more people are working, more people are paying taxes. That means our deficit goes down, and that will help. But we also have to keep control of our spending at the federal level. That's a separate issue. That means passing a balanced budget. That means holding the line on spending. That means making sure we don't spend more than we bring in. So it's a combination of things, Charlie, that you have to do. We think comprehensive tax reform will get the economy roaring again at 3 or 4% growth, and that is good for all of us, and then you got to hold the line on spending. If we do those things simultaneously, that will help bring down our debt and get us back on track.
Will you address the Democrats' contention that past tax cut packages have not resulted in trickle down, that it has actually hurt the middle class and will do so again?
Well, remember, the last time we had comprehensive tax reform was 1986. I mean, I was in high school at the time, so that was 31 years ago. But if you look at comprehensive tax reform, many of the same things that we're doing in this bill in terms of reducing corporate taxes, business taxes, and middle class taxes, same things that were a part of 1986. Look at after 1986, we had one of the biggest expansions of growth in this country's history. The other thing is, it wasn't a partisan issue back then. In the 1986 tax bill, John Kerry supported it as a Democrat. Joe Biden supported it as a Democrat. Al Gore supported it as a Democrat. It was bipartisan. It's unfortunate this has become partisan, but if you look at our congressional district, the vast majority, 95% of the middle class is going to get a tax cut. We believe that's a good thing. We believe businesses, whether you're a mom and pop shop here in Bloomington Normal, or whether you're a plumber, or whether you're a farmer, or whether you're State Farm or Caterpillar, giving them a break. And remember, what happens with tax relief here on our businesses? It means they're going to have higher wages. They're going to hire more people. They're going to reinvest in the community. We think that's a good thing. So we think if you look again at the 1986 tax reform bill, this is a good thing. The other thing that gets doesn't get talked about enough is we are closing a lot of loopholes and special provisions that lobbyists and others have put in place, simplifying the tax code. Cutting taxes for people in the middle class, we think, is a positive, good thing.
Why is a small business corporate tax rate of 20% not achievable and have instead maybe a 25% large corporate tax rate?
Yeah, so what we've done for S-corps and C-corps and small businesses, we've reduced that to 25%. Right now, they're paying somewhere between 35 and 40%. So giving them, again, a tax break to 25%, that's, talk to any small business, that's going to allow them to, again, hire more people, reinvest in their company. If you're a restaurant, you're going to be able to buy a new piece of equipment, maybe buy a new truck. If you're a retail store, you're going to be able to reinvest in your company. So we believe that's a positive thing.
Wouldn't you get more Democrat buy-in by having a lower tax rate on small businesses than large businesses?
Well, on the corporate level, bringing that down to 20%, the corporate tax rate around the world, we compete globally around the world, we're at a significant disadvantage. We're the highest in the industrialized world. So you take the 40 top industrialized countries in the world, we're at the absolute highest. Bringing that down to 20% makes us competitive with, again, Ireland's at 14%, England's at 17%, Canada's at 22%. Bringing it down to 20% is going to make us competitive and put us in the ballpark, and then also help with the repatriation. $3 trillion parked overseas of American companies, their cash reserves over there. Under our bill, bringing it to 20% allows that to come back to this country and get reinvested here. We believe that's a positive thing.
What do you not like about the Senate version?
Well, I think including the healthcare individual mandate, I don't think we should be dealing with that here. That's a healthcare issue. We ought to be dealing with healthcare separately. So I think including the individual mandate is not the right approach to take on this. We ought to focus on tax reform, tax policy. How do we simplify the tax code? How do we make it easier for people to file their taxes, but also get the economy roaring again? I think you got to take that out of there. In addition to that, you have to have, I believe, the deduction for property taxes of less than $10,000. We think that's a positive thing here in Illinois and for our constituents. Those would be the two biggest things. And then lastly, the death tax is another provision that in the House bill, we eliminate that. You talk to any family farmer here in McLean County or anywhere in our district, getting rid of that death tax allows family farms to be able to pass down from one generation to the next. So those would be three provisions that I would disagree with in the Senate bill.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Congressman Darren LaHood. The nation seems at a particular inflection point of some sort regarding sexual harassment and the way it treats women. We've had horrible instances on all sides of the political spectrum, in politics, in entertainment. How do you see the national moment shaping and developing?
Well, first of all, I think it's disturbing and appalling, the allegations that have come forth in all sectors, whether it's politics, whether it's entertainment, in other areas. You know, and I think people have to be held accountable, first of all, whether that's criminally or otherwise. I need to be held accountable for their actions. But hopefully we learn out of this, right? Hopefully we learn and move on and create a better atmosphere so that this type of activity is not tolerated. And whether that means, you know, looking at our current laws in place at the federal and state level and the local level, this type of action and activity can't be tolerated anywhere in our society. And hopefully we can come out of this with a renewed effort to focus on that and treat women with respect the way they should be treated, and we ought to all be focused on that moving forward. The problem, Charlie, is I don't think we're over with the allegations and the instances out there. I think they're going to continue to come forth. And again, I go back to people need to be held accountable. We can't tolerate this type of behavior or actions in our society.
Springfield is one of the places that it's been happening. What have you seen in Springfield?
You know, I served in Springfield for about 4.5 years in the Illinois State Senate. I didn't, in the time I was in Springfield, I spent one night in Springfield. I drove back and forth every night that I was there, so I didn't spend a lot of time there at night. However, I think Springfield is indicative of other places in the country where there's been activity and actions that have gone on by legislators and staff that have engaged in sexual harassment. And, you know, I'm not there now, but obviously they've taken action. The governor just signed two bills last week. I think that's a good approach, but it's raising awareness. It's making sure you hold people accountable, and it's having a strong voice on it.
This sort of thing obviously happens in a continuum. Various reported instances have been more severe than others. At what level of severity do you think it makes someone unfit for public office?
Well, I mean, a lot of times that's up to voters on that, right? But, you know, but other elected officials and other people in power obviously have an opinion on these things. But, you know, many of the instances that I've heard over the last 2 or 3 weeks, there's no place in politics for that type of activity. It's disturbing, it's appalling, and doesn't have a place in, I believe, in elected politics.
Al Franken, Roy Moore. Both should go. Neither should go. What?
Well, listen, I'm not in the Illinois. I'm not in the state. I'm not in the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate, I know, is taking up these actions. But again, the allegations against Roy Moore are disturbing. They're appalling, and he needs to be held accountable for that. And so, if I was in the U.S. Senate, I would not want him as one of my colleagues in the U.S. Senate. And I think his behavior disqualifies him.
Congressman Darren LaHood is a Republican from Dunlap. He represents about three-quarters of McLean County. LaHood spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker following a party breakfast in Bloomington this morning. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner is returning to the campaign trail. Members of the Illinois Politics Roundtable note the theme of Rauner's message is a classic hit, that Mike Madigan is the root of everything that's wrong with the state of Illinois. Sean Crawford moderates the roundtable with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, and Dave Dahl of WTAX Radio in Springfield.
I want to point out a little twist from 4 years ago, and I might point out that 4 years ago, Bruce Rauner said that it was going to be an 8-year thing, so there was no suspense here, and he's salted his campaign coffers with millions of dollars. He said in Decatur, when you see a candidate for the state house, ask, are you going to vote for term limits, and are you going to vote for Mike Madigan as speaker? So that's a little different from, we've got to wipe out Madigan. It has gotten into the governor's brain that most of Illinois is not going to see the name Madigan on the ballot, and the way to get rid of him would be to vote in a lawmaker who would vote for somebody else for speaker.
Is he mentioning the fact he has a primary opponent? Is that coming up at all?
No, it didn't in Decatur, and they cut off the questioning before we had a chance to ask about Jeannie Ives.
And Jeannie Ives, a state representative from Wheaton and considered to be a pretty staunch conservative. She and Brian, you can talk more about this. Some of the reasons that she decided to get into this race. She's upset with Governor Rauner on some decisions he's made. Again, does she pose much of a threat to him?
Let's talk first about why she's in the race. A couple of bills that the governor signed that she and other conservative Republicans don't like. One of them had to do with making Illinois a more welcoming place to people who are in the country illegally. Conservatives have decried it as making Illinois a sanctuary state, but the governor and Democratic backers of the legislation lined up a bunch of law enforcement organizations to say, no, that's not the case. This is, in fact, they called it the Trust Act. They say it's about making it so that if you're in an immigrant community and you're a victim of crime, maybe, you know, you're more likely to cooperate with law enforcement because you're not worried that they're just going to turn you over to the federal immigration authorities, even if you come forward as a victim of crime. Another one, probably even more significant and a more hot button issue to people who believe passionately that abortion is wrong, is he signed a bill that allows for public funding of abortion, either for people in the state's Medicaid program, the program of health care for the poor and disabled and elderly, and also people on the state employee and state university health insurance plans. This is something that he said he would do back during the campaign in 2014. He filled out a questionnaire that said he would support this. And of course, his wife is a big supporter of so-called pro-choice groups. But he also reportedly has told lawmakers that he would veto this legislation. And so he kind of was speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He ultimately decided to sign it. And that seems to really be the thing that pushed some number of Republicans over the edge and inspired Jeannie Ives to State Representative Jeannie Ives to declare her candidacy.
And so does she have much of a shot here? I mean, it's certainly she doesn't have a shot to outspend him. We know that.
No, but she is. I mean, she's raising, tens of thousands of dollars here and there. Virginia McCaskey of the family that owns the Chicago Bears chipped in about $10,000. You know, she has enough money to start traveling the state. There's no way she can match his spending. I think he has 67, 60, I don't want to quote the figure wrong, but I mean, he has tens of millions of dollars in his campaign account and tens of millions more dollars that he can drop in on a moment's notice. But, we'll just have to wait and see how the voters decide. It certainly, even if she's not successful in winning the primary, she can, you know, he's going to be asked about things she says on the campaign trail, and it's going to provide an opportunity for reporters to try and press him on some issues that he would probably rather not talk about, looking ahead to running for re-election in a state that Hillary Clinton won handily and where President Trump is not very popular.
I've got to wonder how many conservatives there are in Illinois who are going to say, yes, I'm going to pull a Republican ballot, but I'm not going to vote for Rauner, I'm going to vote for Ives. I've got to wonder how that pencils out. I would think a lot of people who dislike Rauner would be voting for a Democrat. We'll point out that 4 years ago, Governor Quinn got only about 70% of the primary against T.O. Hardeman.
That's a good point. And Charlie, when the governor goes out, now he has, you know, got a good 3 years under his belt here as governor. Usually when somebody's running for re-election, they tout some of their accomplishments, things they've been able to do. Do you see anything there that the governor can really stand behind that he's been able to accomplish? Certainly this budget impasse overshadows a lot.
I would say the one area where he's had some success, and it's been bipartisan success in that he's worked with legislative Democrats, is in the area of criminal justice reform. They've moved forward on several different issues with the goal of ultimately reducing the prison population by roughly a quarter. But other than that, there's not a whole lot that he can point to. Listening to his talk about 35 years and his talk about Madigan, it occurs to me that when he ran the first time, people voted for him because he was not Pat Quinn, more so than they really liked Bruce Rauner, I think, or at least a lot of people did. And he ran against Quinn, and Quinn's failed governorship. Now he's running against Mike Madigan, hoping that people will vote for Bruce Rauner because he's not Mike Madigan.
His biggest accomplishment is not being Pat Quinn, and I think he's lived up to that. He's also been quick to champion his signing of the school finance bill, and every time he does say that, I think Senator Andy Menar cringes a little bit.
Well, yeah, that's another example where it was a bipartisan effort. He tried to derail it. He failed, and he signed it, and he took credit for it. Governors do that. They sign the bill. They take credit for it. By the same token, when the state's finances go to pot during your time, you can't blame it on people who served decades before you.
Well, Dave, well, let me go back to that. You said that he's, you know, touting the education issue. He has certainly talked before about Chicago schools. He wanted to see more reforms there. Is he bringing that up at all, especially to the downstate audiences?
Didn't hear him mention Chicago. In fact, the bill that he signed is described as a bigger bailout for Chicago than the one that he didn't sign. So it's one of those where we're in the social media world, the soundbite world, 140 characters, the elevator speech, say it in one or two breaths, and as Pat Quinn, I'm sure, still says, if you say it fast enough and you say it enough times, the better it sounds.
Dave Dahl is the news director of WTAX in Springfield. Sean Crawford moderated the Illinois Politics Roundtable with Charlie Weaver, who's the head of the Public Affairs Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Brian Mackey is the State House reporter. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's not just Santa who makes this season merry and bright. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook about some jolly elves in our community who work to make Christmas special for everyone.
For over 30 years, the Children's Home and Aid has worked to make the season merry and bright for everyone with the Adopt-A-Family program. Judy Jacobs serves on the advisory board for Children's Home and Aid, and Laura Cordero is the development assistant and Adopt-A-Family coordinator. She says this is a comprehensive Christmas donation program for people who are currently receiving services from Children's Home and Aid.
We could have anything from an individual foster child up to a family of seven. So this year we have about 180 profiles. A profile is a little bit of a story about the family or the child, and then it is their Christmas wish list. And it is everything from socks and shoes, pants, nightwear, all of those things, and then two wish list items, which could be toys or things for the kids. And then a lot of our parents are very basic, easy things, shampoo, hairbrush. Things that we take, you know, that most of us can afford to pay for and get for ourselves, they don't.
So, Judy, how important is it for, especially for the children, to actually get presents to open up on Christmas morning?
Oh, it's terribly important. We're so used to, you know, used to seeing a tree with lots of presents underneath. And without this program, a lot of these children, these foster children, very low-income families wouldn't have anything under the tree if it weren't for this program. You know, when they're in school, back in school, and kids are talking about what they got for Christmas, and they can say, you know, what they received also.
Do you find that there's more demand this year?
Yeah, we have over 40 more profiles this year than we had last year. So last year we served about 410 people, and this year we're already over 500.
40 sounds like an awfully big burden to do all at once. How are you coping with this?
Very carefully. Usually by this time, we have very few profiles left. But as of today, I still have about 55.
So let's talk about how you deal with the profiles. You've got a list from the families. What happens next?
Whenever I am contacted by a donor, I talk to them about what their giving power is, what they can afford. And then I kind of look at the families that I have.
She tries to match with the donor and what they're able to give with the family, and whether it's a family, if it's one single foster child or a family of six. Some neighborhoods get together and everybody pitches in. We've got a neighborhood here in Bloomington that gives over $1,000. They collect over $1,000 and they adopt several families.
And they've been doing it for about 30 years.
Yeah. So if you want to help and you actually maybe don't have a lot that you could afford to give, you could still help, but just help one particular child rather than a family of six.
Correct. Or you can also make a monetary donation that we could use then to help shop for some of the families.
To even cover one or two items from the list, and we can put several people together. So you could even, if you wanted to make a small contribution, or were only able to make a smaller contribution, that would be fine too. We're happy to accept anything to make to finish out these lists for these families.
So the people who are making the donations, they're actually going out and doing the shopping themselves?
Correct. Yeah. And our donors love it. Absolutely love it. We have a group of ladies from ISU that have been doing it. This will be their 32nd year. And they get a family, and then their group splits up, and one person takes this person from the family, and then one group takes this person. And they get together. They have a brunch where they all meet. They show all the presents that they've bought. They get everything together, and then they deliver it to us on Monday.
But for people like me who don't like to shop, we do have wonderful shoppers. So if people just would like to make a monetary donation and adopt a family, we have wonderful shoppers who will then go out and take care of the list.
Is there a cutoff date?
The very last day that we are taking deliveries of items will be December the 15th. From now until, I would say, like the 10th would be the best time to get a profile. They can contact me either by phone at 309-846-8242, or they can email me at lcordero@childrenshomeandaid.org.
Well, it would just be terrific if the community could help out with these families who really are in need and help them with some very basic things to put under the tree so that they can have a nice holiday like we all do.
That's Judy Jacobs and Laura Cordero from Children's Home and Aid. I'm Laura Kennedy.
There's more than one way to give to this particular project. You can help out Adopt a Family by volunteering to wrap presents. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast, along with interviews you heard today from Laura Kennedy and Charlie Schlenker. Also, thanks to interim Bloomington City Manager Steve Rasmussen for his time on Sound Ideas. We want to know what you think of this program. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.